Bonjour, je m'appelle Frédéric Gagnon et je suis titulaire de la chaire Raoul Dandurand en études stratégiques et diplomatiques de l'UQAM. Vous écoutez le balado de la chaire, le balado qui vous permet d'écouter nos conférences si vous les avez ratées. Le 9 mai dernier, Don Miller, spécialiste de la frontière entre les États-Unis et le Mexique, a présenté la conférence « Climate Change, Migration and the Expansion of the U.S. Border ». En une cinquantaine de minutes, Miller nous a expliqué la relation entre les changements climatiques et la migration. Il nous a aussi parlé du durcissement de la frontière mexicano-américaine au 21e siècle. Je vous souhaite une bonne écoute.
Ça me fait plaisir de vous présenter Todd Miller. Todd Miller is actually a good friend. We kind of spend some time together at the border in Arizona, and he took me to strange places. We took forbidden routes, and we opened some doors where it was said, I don't know, forbidden or something we couldn't go through, and Todd would be saying, off, doesn't mean anything, let's go make it. So, yeah, we've done quite a few things. That was fun. We stood on the other side of the wall, so on the Mexican side, but we were still in the U.S., but it was kind of thrilling to jump the wall. Anyways, so Todd is a journalist, an author. He's been studying the border for more than 15 years, I guess. He lives in Tucson, Arizona, so he knows the border firsthand, and he knows the wall firsthand and the Border Patrol. And that's the title of his first book, which is Border Patrol Nation. Kind of a scary book in a way, and very very accurate as things unfold, because it was written in 2014, and somehow it was you were really predicting the trends that are taking place now. And Todd isn't only writing about the U.S.-Mexican border, but he's also writing about climate change and the border wall, which is actually the best book, maybe the only book I've seen on the matter per se, on climate change and borders and the border wall. So I really recommend it, and because he is a skilled writer. On le lit avec une facilité déconcertante. Donc, c'est vraiment, I'm saying positive things here, just so that you know. So that book was written in, published in 2017. And then the next book, and I'm waiting like for the next book, which is summer 2019, so this summer. And it will be on borders and mobility and how the border, of course, you know that if you are crossing the border here to go to the U.S. By plane, you will be coming across Border Patrol and Customs and Immigration, U.S. Immigration in Trudeau in Montreal. So we are used to see the border in Canada, basically, but it goes much further than that. You will see those agents and a very deep cooperation between those agents and local agents in Kenya or in the Philippines. So the trend we see in Canada of U.S. Border Patrol being deployed on the Canadian territory, which seems kind of logical because we're neighbors, is actually a much more vast movement across the world. So he is going to be, he's writing, well, you have written, it's being published in the hand of your publisher right now. So about that, maybe you can ask him questions. Et puis, Todd Miller est également l'auteur de pas mal d'articles. Vous l'avez peut-être déjà lu dans le New York Times, Time Dispatch, The Nation, le San Francisco Chronicle. So we are very proud, very happy. He's made it. It wasn't an easy trip, but that's why we had to change the time. But we have Todd Miller, and we're very lucky, so I'll leave him with this conference. I'm looking forward to your questions.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for that wonderful introduction. The first story I wanted to bring up was a story of three small farmers I met in Tenosique. Tenosique is in the state of Tabasco in Mexico, about 20 miles away from the Guatemalan border. I was there, and it was June of 2015, and I was there staying at a shelter that was nearby, And it's one of those places where people get on the train to head north, sometimes to places in Mexico, sometimes the United States. And I was in the train yard, and I was kind of wandering around the train yard, and I met these three farmers from Honduras. The farmers, we just got to talking. We talked about, they said that they had been there for 6 days. So just that alone makes my little woes on my plane flight here seem pretty insignificant. 6 days in the train yard. The night before, they had tried to get on a train, get on the train heading north, but it was going too fast. They were planning to go to the United States, and the reason they left Honduras was because there was no rain. There was no rain where they were from, in western Honduras, and no rain, as one of the farmers said, no rain, no harvest, no food, and then a crisis. A crisis. And so it turns out that crisis for those three small farmers was a broader crisis that summer in Honduras alone, according to the government statistics, 400,000 people in western Honduras due to a drought. Or they planted the seeds, many people planted the seeds, and the rains did not come. And as a mayor in a town near where these three farmers live said, it was unprecedented calamity, using those sorts of words. So one of the things I want to really bring up two points with this story with the small farmers. One will relate to the book Storming the Wall that Elizabeth mentioned that tries to connect climate change with displacement and borders and border enforcement. So that's one point, and I'm going to talk about that now for briefly. And I also want to relate it to the forthcoming book, which is titled Empire of Borders, which looks at the kind of U.S. extension of its borders and this impetus to do so, much like as Elizabeth mentioned, the pre-clearance sites that you see all throughout Canada, in Montreal, the idea that you cross the U.S. border like miles and miles away from the actual U.S. border. So what is the U.S. border anymore, right? And so just asking those questions. But first, thinking about the climate change aspect, when, interviewing climate scientists as I was researching Storming the Wall, and in particular in Central America, one climate scientist told me Central America is quote unquote ground zero for climate change in the Americas. And one of the things that he pointed out was that the droughts were happening with more intensity and more frequency. There's a term now that's very frequently used called the dry corridor to refer to places throughout, actually ranging from southern Mexico all the way to Panama, but pretty much centered in Central America. It's called the dry corridor, and these are places that are being impacted by more and more drought spells or dry spells or incidents where they just don't have the rain for their crops. But it's also, as the scientist pointed out, when you look at Central America is an isthmus. It has large bodies of water on either side. Huge storms have spun off of those oceans, like Hurricane Mitch, like Hurricane Stan. Which have caused havoc. Hurricane Mitch, I believe the death toll for Hurricane Mitch was 7,000 people in Honduras and Nicaragua, and that's a late 1990s storm. But all these storms, even the weaker storms, they always produce flooding and mudslides and that sort of thing. So it's either a lot of precipitation or no precipitation. And that's what's being predicted right now for Central America. So when I was talking to the three farmers in Tenosique, I wondered how many more or people who are in those sorts of circumstances might be there. And it's really, when you think about climate change and migration or climate change and displacement, it's a difficult category to parse out of, you know, why people are migrating, because it's so multifaceted. There's so many reasons, so many driving reasons why people are on the move. And like in Central America, it's so often hitting, you know, rural areas. Rural areas like in Guatemala or Honduras, or Guatemala, if you take the western highlands of Guatemala, they're typically marginalized, historically so. Poverty levels could be over 70%, right, in some places. And the indigenous people in Guatemala have been marginalized by systematically for so many years. And then all of a sudden the rains don't come. So it exacerbates pre-existing conditions of I would say, injustice. But, you know, looking at it, to try to look at, for our purposes now, like how much is climate change impacting displacement, there are some numbers that are out there. The International Displacement, our Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, between 2008 and 2015, they estimate approximately 22.5 million people have been displaced due to what they call climate events or climate hazards. And I would imagine those sorts of numbers might be similar, are continuing or even getting higher. One of the things that the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says is that their numbers, they feel, are inadequate because they haven't been able to calculate the slow onset, like a drought. Like drought situations are more difficult to calculate as far as displacement's concerned. So they're trying to figure out with their methodology how to calculate those numbers. As far as projections in the future, the projections for future displacement or migration due to climate change are pretty wide-ranging. If you look at 2050, the numbers range from about 150 million to a billion. So as one person who's done research on empirical research connecting climate change with displacement told me, while these numbers are widely debated, what we can say confidently is that if things stay the same, that we're going to look at the type of human migration that we'll be seeing in the future will be, quote unquote, staggering and without precedent. Right now, in the world, there is no climate refugee status. Of course, it's being debated, like the definition of a refugee in the international realm. Right now, the definition of refugee, of course, is people know. It does not include people displaced for environmental reasons. And different countries have debated, you know, a climate refugee status. I'm not sure about Canada. I know in the United States it's not even on the radar. And the New Zealand's one place that I've heard that's really close to passing legislation that would accept maybe 200 to 300 people per year, looking at Pacific Islanders mainly, who have been displaced due to sea level rise. But those sorts, there's not a refugee status. So when we look at these increasing displacements of people, and a lot of people end up, you know, displaced for environmental reasons, will end up, you know, not going far from home and trying to, you know, in a hurricane situation, so often people try to salvage what's been lost, or a flooding situation, the same thing. But you have more and more and more people who are going to be crossing borders, and that's already showing. And so what happens when people cross borders without authorization from governments? People will be encountering, in this sense, a world of border regimes or border enforcement regimes. Okay, so I want to go back to that day in Tenosique where I was where I'd met the three farmers. And as I was saying, that the night before, the train actually sped up. And it turns out if they had even got on that train to begin with, they would have. There was an immigration checkpoint about a mile or 2 miles down the road or down the tracks from where they were. So I was actually staying at the shelter and heard from people that had got on the train that they had to get off the train because of pretty much an immigration raid on the train. And that's all part of, since 2014 in Mexico, they've had this increased border enforcement known as Programa Frontera Sur, or the Southern Border Program. And I want to, but for looking at the what I've been looking into as far as U.S. border externalization or expansion, I'm trying to look at Mexico's increased border enforcement through the lens of what U.S. border policy has been and the extension therein. And one quote that really strikes home to me is a quote by Alan Burson, and Alan Burson is he's been in the upper echelons of United States Department of Homeland Security. He was a commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, and he was the border czar. He was called the border czar under the Clinton administration. So he's had many high-level positions within the U.S. government pertaining to borders. And in 2012, he said, the Guatemala border with Chiapas is now our southern border. So what does that mean? Alan Burson also is the one that said that in post 9/11, after 9/11, the kind of shift to an international strategy of U.S. border policing was a massive paradigm change for U.S. strategy. And in terms of what was happening in Tenosique that day, you could look at a policy known as the Merida Initiative that comes from the United States. The Merida Initiative is a U.S. military package that was given to Mexico starting in 2008, worth about $3 billion. But if you look at the literature of the Merida Initiative, if you go to what's called the third pillar, it's called the 21st Century Border. And through this 21st Century Border, the United States has begun to supply Mexico with lots of resources, such as Black Hawk helicopters, such as sensor systems, such as biometric kiosks, like biometrics, like digital fingerprinting and facial recognition technologies, and mega checkpoints. And what I mean by mega checkpoints, the checkpoints that, if you go, has anybody been through the southern Mexico? Yeah. If you go through southern Mexico heading north and on many of the main routes, there's a lot of checkpoints you're going to go through. But now there's these checkpoints that are the size of shopping malls. I guess that's the best way I could put it. They're so big that you're no longer on the border. You're maybe 25 miles inland. And if you're on a bus, and that's how I've gone through them myself, if you're on a bus, your bus pulls off, and you have to take all your luggage out, and there's soldiers making sure you do so, and then you pass through the checkpoint as if you're going over the international border again. And these mega checkpoints were mainly financed by the United States. So these are just some examples of how what Alan Burson means when he says the U.S. border is now the border between Chiapas and Guatemala. There's lots of trainings that are involved with Mexico and the United States. And I'm bringing up Mexico, that's because it's one example of many examples of this. But when I was doing an interview with a CBP Customs and Border Protection in their headquarters in Washington, D.C., from the International Affairs Program, they told me at any given moment they thought that there was probably 15 phone calls going on between the United States or CBP and Mexico. They told me that number just to like underscore, you know, the kind of relationship, the intense relationship, and how extensive it is between the two countries. But if you look, like one of the things when you look at the kind of the, again, the massive paradigm change, as Alan Burstyn put it, from the post 9/11, there's a section of the 9/11 2000 or the 2003 9/11 commission report that's worth quoting, I say, because it seems to be like the fuel behind this kind of border expansion. It says 9/11 has taught us that terrorism over there should be regarded just as we regard terrorism over here. In this sense, the American homeland is the planet. And thus, in Montreal, you go through the CBP thing in the airport, right? Because they just can do it because everything's the U.S. homeland, right, according to that logic. Or you could just go to U.S. border strategy, the strategy papers themselves, and see very explicitly the statement that the international boundary of the United States is neither the first nor last lines of quote-unquote defense. So the idea of that border is a line of defense, this one included right here, you know, the border with Plattsburgh, and it's not the first nor last, right? So it implies that this kind of internal in the United States, you have the 100-mile zones, where the border enforcement jurisdictions, you have immigration and customs enforcement that are ICE, that are able to work within the interior of the country. You have, when you look at border and immigration enforcement in the United States, you look at it's the expansion of it's been historic over the last 25 years, really. If you go back to 1994, the INS, which is the Immigration and Naturalization Service, which used to be in charge of border and immigration enforcement, it had a budget of $1.5 billion. And today, if you take the border and immigration enforcement budget in the U.S., and that's by combining Customs and Border Protection and ICE, that's $23 billion. So it's gone from $1.5 billion to $23 billion over the last 25 or so years, which is historic, unprecedented growth. And Border Patrol agents, one manifestation of that is Border Patrol agents. Border Patrol agents in 1994 was where there was about 4,000 Border Patrol agents. And the U.S. Border Patrol started in the United States in 1924. So you have 1924 with a couple hundred to 1994 with about 4,000. And then from 1994 to now, it's gone from 4,000 to 21,000. And Customs and Border Protection is now the largest federal law enforcement agency in the United States. Those combined budgets, again, I don't want to get too much of the U.S. acronyms, I'm sorry, but the combined budgets of CBP and ICE, or Border and Immigration Enforcement, of $23 billion is more than all other U.S. federal law enforcement agencies combined. So the combination of like really well-known law enforcement agencies like the FBI or the Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA, all of them combined, U.S. Marshals, all of them combined amount to less than what the U.S. is spending on border and immigration enforcement. So it's been this massive, massive, massive expansion. And one part of that, especially in the post 9/11 era, has been this international aspect, this international, spreading across the world, that's neither the first nor last line of defense. So we're going out deep into the world. And when I was interviewing those Customs and Border Protection people in Washington about this, I said, if you had one word that you could explain how much these international programs have expanded since 9/11, what would that word be? And he said, exponentially. And one example of this was when I was doing the research for this book that's coming out in a couple months. I'll explain some of the places I went in a minute. But one place I went was Guatemala and a Guatemalan military base in Zacapa. And when I was going to this military base, I was going there to meet with a commander who was part of Guatemala's new border patrol. They call them task forces, but they're really border patrol. So Guatemala has border patrols. Did you know that? Anyhow, so I was going so these are new. These border patrols that Guatemala has are very new. And I ended up being like 2 hours late to the meeting because I was coming from San Pedro Sula in Honduras, and I miscalculated, you know, the amount of time you to cross the border, and then I miscalculated the fact that there weren't buses running at night. So I got to the gate of the military base, and I started begging, you know, the soldiers. I was like, I have an appointment with this commander. Can you let me in? And so the soldiers are pretty nice, and they started making some phone calls. And then finally, one of the soldiers came up to me, and he said, "Are you from BORTAC?" And has anybody here heard of BORTAC? Like, I bring up this word in the U.S., and it's from a U.S. agency. Nobody's ever heard of BORTAC. No one. So I'm here in Zacapa, like 1,500 miles from the United States, and a soldier asked me if I'm from BORTAC. So the only reason I know BORTAC is because I study extensively the U.S. Border Patrol, and I know that the BORTAC is their special forces unit, and I know that BORTAC is a unit that is charged with going and doing trainings abroad, internationally, around the world. So right there, right, you know, it's not that difficult to figure out how much the United States is out there doing trainings. And what BORTAC does, and it's not just Guatemala, as I'll explain, BORTAC goes along with other parts of CBP, and they do these international delegations. They go to different borders around the world, and what they do is they do a diagnostic of the border. Like if they'll go to the Guatemalan-Honduran border, or they'll go to the Bangladeshi-Indian border, or they'll go to, you know, whatever border you want to think of, and they'll do a diagnostic, and they'll say, "Oh, you don't have a border patrol. Why don't you have a border patrol like they did in Dominican and Haiti, between the Dominican Republic and Haiti? You need to have a border patrol, or why don't you have more border barriers, or why don't you have more, you know?" So the diagnostic's given, and then the prescription's given. And in the case of Guatemala, the prescription was you need a border patrol. And in this case, what I was visiting that day was the Chorti, which was the Guatemalan task force border patrol tasked with patrolling the Guatemalan-Honduran frontier. But to get an idea of the expansiveness of it, the United States has, the CBP has 21 attachés in embassies around the world, and they've been described as in-house specialists that kind of coordinate the different programming that's done. Mexico, Brazil, Kenya, London, just to name a few. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, they have 48 attachés around the world. So the fact that they're considered often to be only interior enforcement in the United States is not totally true. They're around the world as well. There's hundreds of programs that the United States, so what the deal here is that in the U.S., there's a Foreign Assistance Act that came out in 1961 that limits foreign assistance to the Department of Defense and the Department of State. So those are the only two departments that can give out foreign assistance. So what DHS has done, Department of Homeland Security, is go through these different agencies and different programs, and there's all kinds of different programs, 100 different programs through which border programs, international programs, can be used internationally to train or send resources to different countries. Really, what you can do, just to simplify it, you could shut your eyes in front of a map and just point randomly to any country, and I'd say that in that country, the United States has done some sort of border assistance. Like, there's one program called Export Control and Border Security Related. It's been in 60 different countries. There's another program called the International Bureau of Narcotics, which so many trainings on different border patrols have happened. That's been in 90 different countries, and those are just two of many different programs. So it's been quite extensive. And in the forthcoming book, some of the places I've been to, just to name a few, and then Just to give you an example, some examples. One is, like I just mentioned, the Dominican Republic, but it's important to mention Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is, again, it's a U.S. territory, right? But it's 1,000 miles away from the U.S. mainland, and but that's the only place outside of the U.S. mainland where there's a border patrol sector. So the U.S. border, you go to the west coast of Puerto Rico, like Aguadilla or Mayagüez or any of those places, and you're going to see green-striped U.S. Border Patrol vehicles roaming down the coast, like if you went to where I live in Arizona. You'll see towers. There's a whole enforcement apparatus that's set up there. And if the west coast of Puerto Rico looks at the Mona Strait, and across the Mona Strait is Dominican Republic and Haiti, of course. And so the patrolling is of the Caribbean. I could go pretty in depth into that, but I'll leave it at that for now. But other places like the Philippines, can you believe it? The Philippines. Why would U.S. Border Patrol agents be going to the Philippines? The Philippines is 7,000 islands, a country of 7,000 islands. But there they are. They're doing trainings in the Philippines. And if you go to Manila Bay, you'll see, if you go to the Coast Guard headquarters in the Philippines, you'll see a bunch of kind of older buildings, which are the Coast Guard headquarters. But then you'll see this new kind of modern, what is called I forget what they call it. It's like a command and control, maritime command watch center. And that was built by the United States in the Philippines. The United States gave $20 million to the Filipino government to build, then contracted the Raytheon Corporation to build this command and control center. And that center, you look at it, and it's extensive all throughout the Philippines. And I talked to different U.S. Border Patrol trainers who have gone to the Philippines, and they talk a lot about maritime security and that sort of thing. In Jordan, Raytheon Corporation also has a contract, almost a $300 million contract, again from funding from the United States government to build a border enforcement system with Syria and Iraq. And so that's happening right now. I went to the border. Kenya, as Elizabeth has documented, the border wall that's being constructed with Somalia. And they also have a border patrol that was trained with resources. First, the whole process of diagnostic, you need a border patrol. It's called the Rural Border Patrol, and there's a border patrol in Kenya. And these are just some examples. I also went to Israel and Palestine. And one of the things that I looked into Israel and Palestine was the kind of industry, the global industry around homeland security and borders, which Israel is one of the top, I guess, innovators. One of the places, definitely per capita, the place where all the cutting edge technologies that are being placed on borders and for homeland security reasons are being developed. And that's what I wanted to see. And I wanted to see how the kind of synergy between the U.S. expansion and the Israeli industries were working together. And so I did go to, one of the things I did is I went to many, many different expos with companies that were with different technologies. And I also did that in Tel Aviv. And the Tel Aviv one was interesting because they were actually demonstrating, they were doing demonstrations outside of the expo center. So I went outside and there was a demo of an orbiter drone, they called it, you could see it. It would fly overhead, and then there's an announcer who was announcing the drone flying overhead, and simultaneously there was this kind of box-like robot that was buzzing around on the ground, which looked kind of cute at first until until he's like, okay, now arm it. And some guy came over and put a Glock pistol and clicked it in there. And then you could see like the kind of shine of the barrel of the gun in the little robot on the ground. So there's a robot on the ground and they're saying, well, you, this could be used. You know, all this stuff is being peddled that it could be used on borders. And he's doing the presentation in English, right? English. So speaking to this international kind of crowd that had gathered there. And then, much to my surprise, the Dogo, not the Dogo, the orbiter, the drone that was flying, he's like, you can barely hear it. And I'm like, yeah, you can barely hear it. Because anyone's here, because if you've heard a drone before, right, you hear the incessant buzzing, like, bzzz, of the drone. And you couldn't hear the orbiter. But the way the orbiter was being sold was that it could do, like, surveillance for, and I'll quote the guy, for 2.5 hours. And then it could actually literally dive bomb a target after that. So it was being peddled as a kind of a suicide drone, so to speak. So that's, I'm just giving you examples like those sorts. I have no idea if whatever what happened with Orbiter, if it was sold to anyone, or if it's been used in that way. It's just an example of the different technologies that are out there that are being peddled, that are like how the future and border escapes are being imagined, right? Whether they happen or not, and that's one of them. But when you look at like the global forecasts for border and homeland security industries, the forecasts are always showing heavy growth. One that I keep going back to, and this one came out a couple years ago now, but it said the border security market is in an unprecedented growth period. And then on top of that, there's now they're adding what they call the Trump effect, right? Because the Trump effect, building upon, like that's gonna, you know, make the border security industry even go higher, and the homeland security industry. The last figure that I saw was about $746 billion forecast for mid 2020s, and for a homeland security. And this is a global, these are global numbers. So looking at the global numbers and the global homeland security numbers of the 2015, I believe were about $300 billion. So what it's essentially projecting is massive continued growth of these sorts of borders and border enforcement regimes going forward globally as we move in to, you know, further into the 21st century. And this is about the time I always mention the research that's done here at the University of Quebec in Montreal around the amount of border walls that are across the world. The fall in 1989, when the fall of the Berlin Wall, there were 15 border walls, and now there are more than 70. And two-thirds of those constructed in the post 9/11 era. That when you look at like those, the kind of global forecasts for homeland security markets and technologies, and this like on the ground nuts and bolts growth of it, you're seeing. And then you take climate change and the kind of displacement projections that are being put forth. There's almost like a collision course, you know. That's happening of a world of displaced people and borders, really, and that's why to tie in climate change and borders, those two things. I want to read. I forgot to, in my haze of today. Of my sleepless haze, I forgot to bring my book, which I was going to read a little piece out of, but I managed to, I think, hopefully remember the quote I wanted to read. And it came from, actually it's a quote from an assessment of the Pentagon, and it's a 2003 assessment. And it's linking climate change with borders. And it says, it's a Pentagon worst case scenario assessment. So it says, borders will be strengthened in the United States to hold back unwanted, starving immigrants from the Caribbean islands, what's it called, an especially severe problem, Mexico and South America. And this is looking into the a future assessment of what climate change is going to cause, and then linking it to the solution to the massive displacement of people is borders, right? And those sorts of assessments with climate change, that was, you know, the idea that somebody in an official report could write the words unwanted starving immigrants. While those words themselves have become more polished, the kind of messaging has been very similar. So if you look at like in 2007, there was a directive from the U.S. Congress to the National Intelligence Council in the U.S. And the directive was to ask scientists and military analysts to come together to do a report on looking at assessments around climate change. So a much more polished version of what I just read was produced, thicker than a book, really thick. And one of the things that they stressed, or one of the main things that they stressed, was that for a military to put out a military platform on a battlefield, and this I'm using their words, it takes 30 years. So in other words, just to take a step back, when you think about like the Trump administration right now, right? You have the Trump administration. The Trump administration, or Trump himself, is a renowned climate denier, right? He's called climate change a hoax probably 5,000 times in various venues. The word itself has been erased from the literature in different departments. But at the same time, like, the government of the U.S. has many, many moving parts, and the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security, they are not climate deniers at all. And one of the main reasons is this 30-year thing that I just mentioned, in that when you look at the Pentagon, for example, in the United States, it has the most kind of clear-eyed risk assessors in terms of U.S. national security out there. So there's no way they're going to deny at all what a 97% consensus of scientists are saying about climate change. There's just no way. They're not doing that. They haven't done that. They haven't stopped doing it with Trump, and they're continuing to do it. So in the U.S., we have this really odd situation where you have a kind of military platforms being thought of in the DoD and DHS sphere, while a kind of wall on the debate is presented, because does it exist or doesn't exist? Or, wow, it's cold out today, so that means global warming is false, right? So you're in this kind of level of debate, while the debate's way past that, and while at the same time you have all these kind of plans for the future with no debate from anyone, you know, no conversation at all. And so that's probably problematic. But so just a couple words about that. In 2010 in the United States, climate change was determined to be a national security threat for the first time, and that set forth a number of things, which mainly that within the mission statements of Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security, they had to put climate change in there as a threat. And the mission statements are the quadrennial reviews. They come out every 4 years. And so in the 2014 quadrennial review for Department of Homeland Security, which is border and immigration enforcement primarily, but counterterrorism, that's, you know, critical infrastructure and cybersecurity, those are the missions. So what they do is, with the other threats they've determined, they put climate change, and they have to look at it through the 5-point mission statement. And in that, in the quadrennial review, of course, and then further, if you look in the DHS documents, they start identifying, you know, the very droughts that are displacing those three farmers that I mentioned, that I met in Tenosique, saying that these are going to displace people and people are going to start coming north. And then the answer to that, if you look at the documents, is that we have to prepare our borders for the potential of mass migrations. So I want to end my talk wondering if all of this is inevitable, right? And And I have a couple stories I want to share. I'll try to make them brief, and then we can go into discussion. But one story is one that I write about a little bit in the new book that I have coming out. And it was in 2014 when the Programa Frontera Sur, the Southern Border Program in Mexico, started. And I was actually on the Guatemalan border I guess there's a part in Ciudad Hidalgo. I don't know if people have been there, but it's right on the border, and you can see the official port of entry. But then below the port of entry, there's rafts that go across go back and forth. And I was actually on one of those rafts, so people just cross back and forth, you know, just pretty freely in that particular place. And I was on one of those rafts, and then I happened to see a soldier. So this is right when Programa Frontera Sur was just starting. I saw a soldier. And I almost like, oh, I gotta go. I was in journalist mode, right? So I was like, I gotta go interview that soldier right away because he was walking along the border on the Mexican side. So I tried to jump off the raft and almost fell into the water. And at the time, there's like tons of people like going all around me. So when I ran up to the soldier, there was this big family from Guatemala, and I'll tell you how I know they're from Guatemala in a second. Well, they're coming from Guatemala, so that's one indication. But I actually meet them. But they were getting off their raft, and I like started talking to the soldier. Are you patrolling the border? And he looked at me and he said, "Are you okay?" He's like, "What? You know, are you okay?" Like I'd run up to him because something happened to me, and I was really just running up to him to ask him. But that wasn't the point of the story. The point of the story was that this family just walked by me, and they looked over and they said, "Hey, can you give me a ride to the United States?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." And then we're just joking back and forth, and then they disappeared. And then of course the soldier, I mean, they just came across in the raft, and the soldier obviously wasn't doing what a U.S. Border Patrol agent was doing. If that same thing happened, they would have went and arrested that family. But I met the family again as we were. I got in a van and we were going to go to Tapachula, when Tapachula is not too far away, which is a bigger city in that area. And we get in the van and just start talking with the family a little bit more. And they're just going to a wake of another family member. So that another testimony to how borders so artificially divide places where, you know, communities are tied together. So they were going to Tapachula for a wake, right? I was in the back, and it just started. They're a jokester family. They had lots of, you know, we were just joking around a lot, and it was really, really, really hot in the van before the van, and we're dripping like with sweat, and they're like, "Oh, so you came here for the weather, right?" You know, stuff like that. But we started going, and then there was an immigration checkpoint that was set up, and we stopped there. But before we got to the immigration checkpoint, the van stopped and looked around and asked people in the van, "Does everyone have their papers?" And then there was a conversation, a kind of murmured conversation in front of me with the family. And then they said something which I didn't hear, and then the van turned around. So I figured we were going back, and they weren't going to be able to go to the wake of their loved one. And so we started going back, and I thought we were going back to Ciudad Hidalgo. But then all of a sudden, the van turned off and started going down this side road, this dirt side road. And one of the family members, as we proceeded, one of the family members looked around and said, "We don't have any papers." She started laughing, you know, she just said it with like this kind of defiant zeal, you know, and that's what happened. We were able to subvert the border and with a coordination with the van drivers and the family, and they were able to get around, and we got around the checkpoint, and lo and behold, we ended in Tapachula. And I just mentioned that story because those sorts of stories are just abundant, I'm sure. Like any border you go to, there's always this kind of creative evading of the apparatus, so to speak, getting around. How do you coordinate to get around where it's set up? And then the last thing I want to mention and want to end with is in thinking about the inevitability of everything. And it's just outside of Agua Prieta, in which is on the border of Arizona, close to where I live. Just to the west, there's a place called the San Bernardino Ranch. And in this place, there's a binational ecological restoration project that's happening. And I went there a couple times for research for Storming the Wall. And I remember the first time I went, and the guides immediately took me to a place where the actual parts of the U.S. border barrier had been, they were dragged a quarter mile inland into Mexico, mainly. So in 2014, there was a Hurricane Odile, actually, that unleashed tons of water and on rain on the Chiricahua Mountains, which are in eastern Arizona. And what happened was then the rain just came flooding through the washes and then slammed into the U.S.-Mexico border. I say slammed because there's barriers or walls on much of the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona, and took parts of the wall into Mexico. And this is one part of it, right? It was a vehicle barrier, actually, but it was when I looked at it, it was amazing to me because it was obvious that Mother Earth was eating the border barrier. It was being consumed by the ground. There was dirt on, you know, it was embedded in the dirt. There was actual purple flowers growing off of it. There's a rack, like spider webs coming from it, right? So in other words, left alone, the border infrastructures would be eaten alive, right? That's the message I got. Of course, where I was standing, and it was on a dry wash, I could see that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security had reconstructed the barrier and the actual borderline. And there was a U.S. Border Patrol agent there, and there was a really high-tech new surveillance tower that they had constructed. And mind you, remember, the budget is $23 billion, so there's a lot of money being at play. And before you get to the border barrier, they put gabions in the wash, and gabions are like steel cages filled with rocks meant to slow down the rain. When the rain's coming, it slows it down, and then the soil can absorb the water. And the gabions themselves actually looked like a wall itself. But it wasn't a wall, right? It looked like one of those intricately carved stone walls you might see someplace. But what was happening was that it was indeed doing what they had proposed. It was, the water was being absorbed. They were showing me that the grasses were growing back. So this is a place in Arizona in a 15-year drought. A 15-year drought, which is, if you look at the climate projections for northern Mexico and the southwest United States, drought, no rain, all that is the huge part of the projections. And this particular place, 15 years. And to see, like, desert willows growing back, animals returning. And then they told me what I thought was a miracle. They said the water table had risen 30 feet. So all around, all the water tables had been going down. Here, the water table had risen 30 feet. And I said, that's a miracle. And they said, no, that's not a miracle. We just piled up some rocks. And then when the water table rose, it rose on the U.S. side and the Mexico side. So if you talk to people on the U.S. side, they were very happy about that, right? And that there's a wildlife refuge across the border. Right now, actually, it was just announced yesterday that a new border wall is going to be constructed right in that very place. And then the third thing is that a community just near there, they started seeing water in places they hadn't seen water in a long time. If you go back to those assessments, one of the assessments about northern Mexico is that water or scarcity of water is going to drive displacement of people. So here's this project. It's still small scale, right? It's small scale, but it's showing that that conditions that are happening as predicted by scientists due to climate change can at least be alleviated somewhat by, you know, humans coming together, in this case across borders, and creating something completely different. And so what I did was I asked one of the founders of the project, and at the time the budget was $20 billion, so you can see how the budgets keep rising and rising, especially under the Trump administration, they're rising even faster. So I asked one of the founders, what could you do with $20 billion? And then the founder responded, and I always say that I just had my notebook. I wish I had my recorder, because she just started talking about what she could do with that $20 billion. And she started talking about places so far away that I hadn't even heard of them before. And that's what I, you know, when I do this talk, especially in the United States, I leave it there. Like, what? Like, here we are, year after year, we have higher and higher budgets for border and immigration enforcement. But yeah, when you think of like what security is, right? And especially like you think about climate change, like in Arizona, drought is a huge issue. Like, what if that money, can't that money be spent on something else? Like, couldn't that money be spent on something, you know, that could really improve the well-being of people, of humanity? I'll leave it at that, and we can, you know, have discussion. And thanks for bearing with me. I was trying to put two like books into one presentation, and that was the first time I've ever done that. So, yeah. So.
Vous avez aimé cette conférence de Todd Miller? Vous voulez en apprendre plus sur ses recherches et ses publications, ou encore sur son nouveau livre paru cette année, qui s'intitule Empire of Borders, The Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World? Tous les liens se trouvent sur la page de l'événement sur notre site Internet. Et pour rester à l'affût des activités de la chaire, pour participer à nos conférences en personne, bien, suivez-nous. Vous pouvez nous suivre sur Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Vous pouvez aussi vous abonner à notre infolettre du mardi directement sur notre site Internet. Donc, on se retrouve très bientôt pour un autre balado de la chaire.